this is a very exciting, our very first guest lecture, and I'm very honored to be present Ken McGurdy from the University of Chicago, who will tell us about quivers and lattices.
Thank you.
So I want to tell you about two classification problems, I guess, which hopefully will sound quite different when I tell you what they are, but then magically they'll have the same answer, pretty much. So the first thing we're going to talk about is lattices, because, well, it comes first in the alphabet, I don't know. And so a lattice is just a discrete subgroup of a vector space, but I'll be a little bit more formal. So let's say L is a free abelian group. With a bilinear form. Which is integer valued, so that's sort of the interesting part. and the vector space will just be, what do I call it? RV. So if you don't like tensor products, don't worry about it, just think of having a vector space, and inside it, a discrete subgroup, and the vector space has an inner product, or this bilinear form, because this bilinear form then extends over here. And we're interested in positive definite lattices. Positive definite lattices. So that just means that this bilinear form is symmetric positive definite. Okay, now we could stop here and say let's classify all of these things, but that's way too hard. so we're going to do something easier. And to warm up, I guess, well, I'll tell you, if I have some element of the lattice, let n of v, the norm of v, the norm of v, just be the pairing of v with itself. So we can ask, the lattices generated by vectors of norm 1, right? So you can look at the whole lattice and you can ask, well, are there any vectors which have norm 1? And then ask, well, do they generate the lattice or they generate a sublattice anyway? And so this turns out kind of a boring question because you get z to the n, with the obvious pairing, which is just the multiply the coordinates and add them. So the standard bilinear form on this thing. So, you know, okay, we asked a reasonable question, we got a reasonable answer, but it wasn't all that exciting. So we asked this slightly harder question. I guess here I really meant positive definite. So I'm assuming all the time that it's a positive definite lattice. What about lattices generated by norm 2 vectors? Now, this has a more interesting answer. I should point out maybe at this point that if you change the 2 to a 3, I think you get an unsolved problem. So, sort of, it gets much harder, much very quickly. Okay, so what do we do? Okay, let R be the guys in the lattice which have norm 2. And I'll give them a name, I'll call them roots. Now, to each root, to each V in R, we can associate a hyperplane which there's only one thing to do. We have a vector and we have a bilinear form, so there's an obvious hyperplane. And that's the vectors in V, which are perpendicular or orthogonal to little v. Okay, so we get a bunch of hyperplanes. Now, the form is positive definite, so there's only finitely many of these roots. It's a compactness point, I guess. So we have a finite set of hyperplanes inside our vector space. So you can take out all the hyperplanes from the vector space and you get some open subset, and it's a union of connected components. It is a union and I call those components chambers. Okay, so the picture you should have in mind is the following. So if I was in R2 and all these were 60 degrees, then we get an example. So my lattice has these vectors here in norm 2, and each vector determines this line or hyperplane in general, and so the collection of hyperplanes is just the set of these lines, and the complements are these regions here. And so any connected component is what I'm calling a chamber. So any one of these sort of triangular regions is the chamber in this picture. Okay? Now, we want to pick a chamber, but at first that might seem, well, you know, I said pick, so it kind of sounds like a choice. But that's sort of bad. We care about classifying the lattice, and so making an arbitrary choice along the way is sort of a dangerous thing to do. And so I first want to say that really it's not dangerous. Let's see. Have what I'll call R sub V, the reflection in HV, reflecting in the hyperplane, is a linear transformation of this vector space. And what is it? If I have some vector, what is the reflection? Well, it's the following. It's x minus twice the inner product of x with v divided by the norm of v times v. Okay? So, in the case when v is a root, which is I guess I was assuming up here, this is 2, right? So this actually equals x minus x comma v with v. Now, so if x is in the lattice, then when you apply the reflection, you get something in the lattice, right? Just because this is an integer by assumption. Hence, this guy is actually an automorphism of the lattice. Okay? Now, given any pair of chambers, let's move over here, which have a common wall, so if you look at a chamber, it has walls, which are hyperplanes, which sort of bound it. To be more precise, you could look at the closure of the chamber, and there will be some hyperplanes such that the intersection of that closure with the hyperplane will be open in the hyperplane, and some for which it won't. I mean, if you look at the intersection for this guy, you just get one point. So this guy's not a wall of this chamber, but these two are. So it's what you're intuitively thinking, but if you actually want to write it down, you need to say something complicated like what I just said. Okay? So so if we have two chambers, separated by a wall, HV, then it's easy to check that if I reflect this chamber by reflecting in the wall, it'll map this chamber to this chamber because it's preserving the whole lattice. This preserves the whole lattice, so it will preserve the connected components, and these guys have a common wall, so there's only one component this guy can go to. Okay? But, you know, now travel as far as you can go. So you can, given any two chambers, you can apply an automorphism of the lattice to get from here to here, but then you can apply another one to get to here and keep going. And it's pretty easy to see from there that all the chambers are actually conjugate under automorphisms of the lattice. So using this, we see any two chambers are what I guess I'll call conjugate. Under linear maps on the vector space, which preserve the lattice, automorphisms of the lattice. So if I pick a chamber, I'm not really messing things up. Any other chamber is just obtained from the chamber I picked by an automorphism. Okay? So given a chamber, let, I'll call it delta, be the set of roots such that this guy is a wall, and so that determines two roots, right? There's one of them and minus it. And so we also want to insist, and V X is positive for all X in the chamber. In other words, we're picking the root, which is on the same side as of the hyperplane as the chamber. Okay? Now, we have the following lemma, which is sort of controlling everything. If I have two, V and W, say? R. If I have V and W in delta, V not equal to plus or minus W, I mean, I guess you'll never get plus or minus. Then if I look at the, the pairing of these guys, it's either zero or it's minus one. Okay? So how do we prove that? Well, this thing is less than or equal to something. There's like a name for this and everything. And these guys are roots, right? I should say this is the Cauchy-Schwarz inequality. Just, you know, it's copyrighted probably. Right. And if there's any Russians in the audience, it's also due to Bunyakovsky. Or maybe even if there aren't Russians in the audience. I like Russians. I just want to make that clear. So this is the square root of 2, and this is the square root of 2. So together they're 2. And so this is less than or equal to 2. So we have possibilities minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, and 2. Now, I said this up here because I don't like even numbers. And so there's only really 0, 1, and minus 1. So this equals 2. So so we must have, Okay, so because of this, I mean, we must have this inner product lying in the set 0, 1, or minus 1. So I'm just saying it has to be 0 or minus 1, so the only thing I have to do is rule out the possibility of it being 1, right? So if this is equal to 1, then I can apply the reflection in the hyperplane determined by V to W, and this will be equal to W minus V. Now, draw a picture. And this, more importantly, is a root, right? This guy is in the lattice, this thing preserves the lattice, and so this guy has to be in the lattice. It's also it's a reflection, so it's an orthogonal transformation, so this guy must also have norm 2, so it's actually a root. So it's in the lattice, and it has norm 2, so it's one of these guys. But then this hyperplane separates V and W, so they can't be the walls of the same chamber. And the picture is the one that I erased, so I'll try and draw it again. The point is that we have sort of V here and W here, and W minus V is over here, and so this is the plane, and it separates these two guys. So if you were looking at the chamber, this would be passing through the chamber, which can't be happening because it's not supposed to contain anything in a hyperplane. So in other words, we can't have it equal to 1, so we can only have it equal to 0 or equal to minus 1. Okay? So what we do now is we draw a graph. We construct a graph gamma L, because gamma is L upside down, with nodes corresponding to, well, the elements. Of delta and an edge. Let's see if I have node V joined to W if this is equal to minus 1. So you have a graph. So you number your roots somehow, things in delta, the roots which are attached to the walls of a given chamber. And then you draw this graph where you put an edge between the node corresponding to two roots if their inner product is minus 1 and no edge if the inner product is 0. Okay? And so what we do, we turn our problem of classifying lattices into our problem of trying to classify possible graphs. And this graph's impossible, turns out. but why, you say, or you don't say, because you're asleep. and the why is the things... This is where the math talk turns into a cookery program. And I say, here's something I prepared earlier. so what we do to try and classify these graphs is we cunningly look for graphs that can't happen. So, look at the graphs, which I've called A n tilde, D n tilde, and EN. There's only three of the E's, there's 6, 7, and 8. There's infinitely many of these guys. And so what we want to do is suppose one of these guys was a subgraph of this graph. Okay? So suppose one of these, I'll just call it gamma, is a subgraph of the graph that we've just built. Okay? Now, you'll notice that there's numbers on the nodes of this graph, and there's a reason for that. Then I'll call it V, be the sum is it okay if I call it VI? Where these guys are the roots corresponding to the subgraph, and the MI are the labels. Okay, so you would sort of, in this picture, take this root plus twice this root plus three times this root, etc., etc. Okay? Then we do the following calculation. Let's look at the inner product of V with one of these VIs. Well, what is it equal to? you get twice the inner product, or sorry, you get 2, which is the inner product of VI with itself, times MI, minus the sum of, I'll just write it like this, the guys that are joined to I, MJ, right? Because these guys have inner product minus 1, and this is inner product 2, right? But this is equal to 0. So that's what you have to rush back over here and check. If you look at any number here, it's half the sum of the numbers adjacent to it. And you just check on all these graphs that that's true. It's pretty easy for that one. but what does this mean? V has inner product 0 with all of VI. So it must have inner product 0 with itself because it's just a combination of the VIs. Okay. That means that this must be 0 because it's positive. This inner product is positive definite. But if I pick something in our chamber, then this is positive for every VI. It's positive for everything corresponding to the nodes here, so we have some subset of those nodes. So this is certainly true. And the MI are positive, right? All those labels are positive integers. So the scalar product of X with this vector V is positive, so this vector can't be 0, but it has to be 0. Okay, so we lose. I mean, we win, actually, but the graph loses, right? So gamma is not a subgraph of gamma L for any gamma in this set that I just okay? Now that's an amazingly strong condition, because look at these graphs, right? The fact that, so if you let n equals 4 here, these two nodes sort of collide into each other, so there's only 5 nodes. So this is a node which has 4 guys adjacent to it, and you can't have that. So given every node in this graph, it has valence at most 3. Valence is the number of nodes attached to you. Okay, so every node has valence at most 3. And now, if you let this get bigger than 4, you realize that there can only be one node of valence 3, because if there was two, then, I mean, one node in each connected component of the graph, I guess. We should sort of just work connected component by connected component. But in each connected component, there can only be one node of valence 3. Okay, so that's good. So now you know your graph looks sort of, you have one node of valence 3 and there's sort of three strings coming off of it. How long can those strings be? Well, you have the impossibility of this subgraph. So one of the strings has to be length at most 1. So that, and then you have these subgraphs, so that cuts it down even more. And so what you end up getting is that the graphs have to be of the following kind. You rub off the tildes, and then you take the shaded node, and you get rid of it. And what you find out is that the connected components of the graph gamma L have to be of exactly this form, just by using the fact that the connected components of gamma L don't have any of the guys before I erased a node as subgraph. So you're actually done. Every lattice generated by norm 2 vectors is an orthogonal direct sum of lattices corresponding to these graphs. Now, of course, you might be complaining that I just constructed these graphs and said, okay, only these graphs are possible. You then have to go and think and check that given one of these graphs, there actually is a lattice corresponding to it. But that's not, it turns out, so hard. It's not anywhere near as hard as erasing the blackboard, for example. So for AN, what do you have to do? It's the following. You look at vectors. I don't know why I'm calling them Ns. That's a bit weird. Inside z to the n, such that I really meant n plus 1 if I have an n here, such that their sum is 0. Okay, and you can check this is generated by vectors of the form 1, comma, minus 1, 0 is everywhere else. So those will give you the things corresponding to the nodes here, and you can check that you get the graph exactly of this type. For dn, you have the following lattice. You have now a1 to an in z to the n, and the condition is now that this sum is an even integer. Okay, and then turns out the easiest one to write down is e8. And that's 8 tuples, but it's sort of slightly more complicated. Right. The sum has to be an even integer. And I'm running out of space. And all of the AI lie in Z, or all lie in z plus 1/2. So that's why I have an R8 here, because they're not actually integral points in the obvious spaces. They're either all integer coordinates, or they're all out by 1/2 from being integer coordinates. And to get the graph out of here, you need to look at things like, you know, 1, 1 or 1, comma, minus 1. And to look in here, you do the same thing, except there's one cunning vector at the end, which has a 1/2 in it. You have all the coordinates equal to plus or minus 1/2, and check. I didn't write it down. But there's a cunning eighth vector, which has halves in it, and that's the only one you have to think about. You pick sort of standard, you know, 1, comma, minus 1 sort of vectors here, and then the eighth vector is this guy lying in this set. And so you can just check that these correspond to an, dn, and e8, and e6 and e7 just then sit inside e8. So these seven are things in E8 such that A1 equals A2, and E6 are the things in E8 such that A1 is A2 is A3. Okay, so you can check that all these form sublattices. I mean, they obviously form sublattices, but that they correspond to these two graphs, sorry. And so that's the complete answer. Any lattice generated by norm 2 vectors is just an orthogonal direct sum of these lattices. Okay, so now for the second part, which is going to sound completely different for the moment, but we have a question. Because it's generated by, if you look at the vectors you have giving the walls, then they generate the whole lattice. So once you have a configuration of vectors in vector spaces with the appropriate inner product, it'll generate sort of exactly one lattice. That's sort of. But yeah, good question. But this reduction to a graph didn't lose any information. So, in some sense, we should have a break, but we don't have time, so morally have a break. Now I'm going to talk about quivers. I don't know why they're called quivers, really. They're directed graphs, which are usually called directed graphs. But in sort of this area of mathematics, they're called quivers, which is sort of a slightly more romantic name, I guess. So a quiver. Exactly. I'll need sort of notation, which is why I'll write this. Has a set of nodes, which are indexed by the set I, and arrows H, where where for an arrow H, we let S of H be sort of, and T of H be the nodes that the arrow starts and ends at. Should have really said terminate. Right. And also S and T are consecutive in the alphabet, so it's just sort of irresistible. Okay, so that's just our notation. We have a graph with a set of nodes and a set of directed edges. Okay? So now I want to introduce the notion of a representation of a quiver. So a representation of Q is let's put it this way. It's an I-graded vector space. Graded. Right? So it's a direct sum of vector spaces indexed by the nodes and a collection of linear maps which I'll denote X of H, one for each arrow, and X of H is a linear map from the vector space corresponding to the node that the arrow starts at to the vector space that the node ends at. Okay, so you just have the graph, you put vector spaces over each of the nodes, and every time you have an arrow, you specify a linear map from one vector space to the other. Okay? So this is what we're going to call a representation of a graph, of a quiver. Now, in case sort of the notion of a representation of a graph seems sort of strange, we can relate this to an algebra and then just talk about representations of that algebra, which is maybe sort of slightly more familiar. So this gives a notion equivalent to representations of, I'll just give it a name and then tell you what it is. I'll call it K of Q. I should maybe, so I said these things were vector spaces, but I never said over what field, and sort of for the moment it doesn't matter, so I'll just call the field K. And so this K is the field. And what is the algebra? It's an algebra of paths, where K of Q has a K basis consisting of paths, in Q, and multiplication given by composition. So, I mean, of course, you can be more formal here, but for example, if I had this quiver, then K of Q, let's say, So I want to have paths of length zero. So they just sort of are a vertex and they stay there. And then I have, sorry, the path going from 1 to 2, the path going from 4 to 3, and the path going from 3 to 2. And then the path going 4, 3, 2. Okay? So a path is just a sequence of edges where the end of one edge is the start of the next edge. So a path. No, I don't. Just these guys. I mean, well, yeah, no, I don't want. So this, no, it is, because you have the sum of these guys is the identity. Yeah, that's what I was just thinking. You do want an identity, but you already have an identity. So if you threw in the null path, you would kind of have another identity. That's not a good idea here. So in general, if you start with any quiver, you can get an algebra in this way. Now, I just said a representation in this sense over here was supposed to be a representation of this algebra. Well, you know, not quite, but, you know, what do you need here? You need, given any one of these paths, a linear map. So if I start with a vector space, which is a representation of this algebra, apply one of these guys are idempotents. If I multiply this path by itself, it's itself, like stay at the vertex, stay twice, and you're still there. So this splits up the representation into a direct sum. So that's the corresponding to this here, starting with a graded vector space. And then this algebra is obviously generated by the paths of length 1. And over here, you're told what happens to paths of length 1. So the data over here exactly gives you the data of a representation of this algebra. Okay? So representations of the graph, in this sense over here, are just representations of this algebra. Okay? So So I want to restrict my quivers a bit. So the question we're interested in is understanding this category of representations of the quiver or of the path algebra of the quiver. Now, sort of, this is a quiver. Understanding representations of this, say over an algebraically closed field, is the Jordan canonical form, right? A representation of this is just a vector space and an endomorphism. So to understand all possible such things up to isomorphism is just to classify matrices. Okay? So we want to have a slightly easier time in some sense. We want to restrict two quivers without cycles or, well, I think I just want to say without cycles for the moment. And that counts as a cycle. I was going to write or loops, but. Okay. So I guess the first thing to notice that if you have, say, studied representations of finite groups or something over C, then what do you do? You do all this character theory nonsense, but before you get there, you sort of say, well, you know, there are representations, there are irreducible representations, and irreducible representations are sort of what everything's built out of. Any representation of a finite group over C is a direct sum of irreducible representations. Was that? I mean oriented cycles. For a finite group, you just have representations as direct sums of irreducible representations. And so you just classify irreducible representations and then sort of say you're done and go home and drink or something. Is everyone over 21? Here, the sort of finding the irreducibles, that's really easy, but it's also kind of less useful. So here, the irreducibles of the form sort of what I'll call SI for I some node, where SI at some node J is the zero vector space if J is not equal to I, and it's the one-dimensional vector space if J is equal to I. Okay, so you just put a one-dimensional vector space over a single node, and everything else is zero, and all linear maps have to be zero because they go from somewhere to zero or zero to somewhere. and this is obviously simple. And it's also the case that any simple is of this form. So that would be an incredibly sort of simple answer to the story if it were the case that all representations were direct sums of simple representations. But that's not true. K of Q has representations which are indecomposable but not simple, but not irreducible. So irreducible means that you have no sort of sub-representation that isn't zero or the whole thing. Indecomposable means that you can't write it as a direct sum of two things. So, you know, a priori there are different notions, and for finite groups and for complex representations of finite groups, what you do is you show if you're irreducible, if you're indecomposable, you must be irreducible. But that's not true as a completely general statement. And it happens here very, very quickly. Let's look at this quiver, and let's put, I mean, I'll do this over C, it doesn't really matter. And let's make this map an isomorphism. Okay? So, if I just take the subspace, the zero vector space over here, and C here, it's a sub-representation, right? It's preserved by this linear map, and that's all you have to be. But you can't find a complement to this. if you pick anything over here, it maps isomorphically onto that, and then you're sort of tangled into this representation. So this representation is indecomposable, but it's not irreducible because it has this subobject. Okay? So the category of representations for this algebra is one where you will have indecomposables which may not be irreducible. There's still a sort of very general theorem called the Carl-Schmitt theorem, which tells you that every representation of this algebra will be a direct sum of indecomposable representations in an essentially unique way, but the indecomposables are more complicated than the irreducibles. So I need one more kind of just piece of notation. Given a representation of Q, it has a dimension in N to the I. Which is just the graded dimension. Look at the dimension of each graded piece. So for each node you have a vector space, remember that dimension. So not sort of just the sum of the dimensions, you remember the dimensions of the piece on each node. Now, if we fix So if I fix what the dimensions at each node is, a representation of Q on V is an element of this big vector space. Oops, that's supposed to be an H. Okay, so if I fix the vector space, the possible representations are just possible choices of linear maps here. So I'll give this thing a name. I'll call it E sub Z. And then when are two representations isomorphic? Give isomorphic representations if we have a bigger piece of chalk. If they're conjugate under the action of this group I'll call G sub V, which is the product of the general linear groups for each I. So this group acts on this space by sort of conjugating. You can, if you have a linear map from here to here, you can act by a group element here, then apply the linear transformation, and then apply a group element over here. And so this gives you an action of this group on this big vector space, and the orbits of this group are exactly the isomorphism classes of representations that you get on this fixed vector, on this vector space of a fixed dimension. Okay, so I'll use that in a little bit. but what I want to say, so I still haven't given you sort of a classification problem, or rather you could say, let's classify it for any quiver, but that's kind of way too hard. so Gabriel asked the following question. If I have a quiver, when is it the case that there's only finitely many indecomposable representations? So another way of saying the same thing is, if I know there are finitely many indecomposable representations, then it's because every representation is a sum in a unique way of indecomposables. That means that in a fixed dimension, there's only finitely many isomorphism classes of representations. So you can ask the question in two ways. You can say, once I fix the dimension, is there just finitely many different isomorphism classes of representations of that dimension? Or you can ask the question, are there finitely many decomposables? It's the same question. Okay, so a quiver which has this property is called a quiver of finite representation type, or finite type. And so Gabriel proved the following kind of remarkable result. A quiver Q has finite type if and only if the underlying sort of undirected graph so take your quiver and forget that the arrows were arrows and just think of them as edges is a union of the diagrams dn. So over here we have these diagrams, and the theorem is, I guess maybe it would be easier if I just said let Q be connected or something, it doesn't matter. If you look at the quiver and you forget the direction of the edges, then you'll get just a graph, and the graph must be one of these. Okay, so that's kind of remarkable. And it gets slightly better, but we need more space. So the theorem tells you that, okay, you look at the quiver, forget where the arrows are going, and see if it's one of these graphs here. If it is, then there are only finitely many indecomposables, right? That's one of the ways of saying finite type. And so Gabriel also showed that, moreover, the dimension vectors of the indecomposables correspond to I'll explain this in a second, roots of the corresponding lattice. Okay, so given one of these diagrams, we showed before that there's a lattice corresponding to it, generated by vectors of norm 2. And if you look at the walls of a chamber, we found these guys corresponded to certain roots. If you take various integral combinations of these roots according to what the dimension vector is, right? So just like we did with the extra diagrams, we built a vector out of a labeling on this diagram. You do the same thing with the dimension vector. This turns out to give you a root of this lattice. And if you take sort of plus or minus, so these will all have positive coefficients. If you add in all negative coefficients, then you get every root of the lattice. So every root of the lattice, of course, is plus or minus the dimension vector of the indecomposable representation. So this problem of classification of quivers of finite type turns out to be sort of the same as the classification of lattices. And I have a tiny bit of time to at least tell you how, well, tell you one direction of this theorem in the case where we work over a field which is algebraically closed. Yeah, I mean, loops are bad. Loops will give you infinite representation type straight away. But it's also true independent of the field. Actually, I never at any point said what the field had to be. And so the classification of indecomposables is independent of the field.
I'm going to assume K is algebraically closed. And suppose Q has finite representation type.
Well, then what's supposed to happen? Then this group here has finitely many orbits. On this vector space. So what was here right before I erased it? You pick a vector space of fixed dimension. All representations of that dimension correspond to elements of this big Hom space, and the orbits under this group correspond to the isomorphism classes. So if I'm in the case where there are finitely many orbits, there are finitely many indecomposables, there will be finitely many isomorphism classes, which means finitely many orbits of this guy on this guy. Therefore, GB has an open dense orbit. So, the dimension of GV has to be greater than or equal to the dimension of this guy.
Right?
A little better, plus one. Because inside this group, you have a product of scalar matrices, and the way you act is kind of by conjugation. So scalar, diagonal copies of a scalar inside this group act trivially. So really, maybe I should have a minus one on this side rather than a plus one on that side, but, you know. So we have this inequality for all, for every graded vector space V. But now just work out what these are. So this thing is just the sum over the nodes of di squared, right? And GV is an open subset of matrices. And the dimension of EV is the sum over the edges of the dimension of the start times the dimension of the terminating vector space. Okay, so if I let C be the following matrix, Cij, where Cij is 2 if I equals j, it's minus 1 if I is connected to j or j is connected to I, doesn't matter, and 0 otherwise. So translating the fact that this guy minus 1 has to be greater than or equal to this guy, we get, I'm just writing it out with this matrix, we get that D times C times D transpose has to be greater than or equal to 0. Greater than or equal to 1, actually. Strictly greater than 0, I guess, is the nicest way to put it. If D is in N sub I and not equal to 0. Okay, so you just rearrange this thing into this fashion. And what it tells you is that this matrix has to be positive definite. And this is then exactly the same sort of condition as we had earlier with lattices. What we did with lattices was we produced this graph, and then the way we controlled what possible graphs you got was with these diagrams with an extra node showing that there was some vector which had norm 0, which couldn't be 0. And this C is giving you sort of the inner product of the lattice. And so the condition here is that inner product is positive definite. Pretty much. I mean, this is insisting that these guys have positive coefficients, but pretty much it's the condition that it's positive definite. And so it gives you, when you run away with this problem, you can solve it in exactly the way we solved the lattice problem, and so get the quiver underlying, or the graph underlying the quiver, is a thinking diagram, or is one of these ADE diagrams. And in fact, the roots are the guys where this equals 1. And so at least in the algebraically closed case, that says that this dense orbit, an element in that dense orbit, has a very small, has a dimension 1 automorphism group, which pretty much tells you that it's indecomposable. So the things corresponding to roots are the indecomposables. But in fact, the theorem is true if you throw away the algebraically closed. It's just, I don't have time. But thank you.
Questions?
I use this algebraic geometry fact that I have a dense orbit. I mean, over a finite field, I sort of, for example, can't quite use this, but the theorem is still true over FQ. So there's another way of approaching this problem, which is sort of blind to the field. Uses these things called reflection functors, which were invented by Bernstein and Gelfand and Ponomarev, which basically uses the fact that they knew the answer. Gabriel did this with his bare hands, so to speak. But once you know that there is this connection with sort of roots and lattices and these reflections, they found a way of sort of making a algebraic incarnation of that reflection by a root, which is a sort of reflection functor. It takes your quiver and it sort of flips the direction of arrows. So they also used the fact that they knew the answer didn't depend on the orientation, so you might as well deal with all orientations at once. And so they produce functors which sort of send indecomposables to zero or another indecomposable. And you just sort of apply these functors again and again and again until you hit an indecomposable that's simple. And then the only guys that get killed and sent to zero are simples. So they construct these functors and then sort of say, well, if I keep hitting my indecomposable with one of these guys, I can eventually kill it. And just before I killed it, I made it simple. And we knew what the simples are. They're just things corresponding to vector space. I mean, corresponding to a node. And so sort of just forgetting everything but the dimension, you kind of see that what this is doing is taking, if you know, sort of the algebra's simple roots to an arbitrary root by an element of the Weyl group. So this is sort of a really nice way of realizing that you should be able to see some of this sort of lattice and Weyl group and Lie algebra machinery in this world. So it doesn't work on the nose because some things go to zero, so it's not an automorphism. But in fact, that turns out to be kind of a good thing. Because killing things right before you kill things, they're as simple as they can be. So that's very vaguely how you do it without noticing what the field is. Which sort of makes sense. I mean, it's a very sort of pure linear algebra problem. It's maybe believable that you don't need to know what the field is. I mean, we actually did it for this quiver, right? We had the representation which had one vector space here and one vector space here and an isomorphism. That's the only indecomposable representation that isn't a simple one or an irreducible one. And that's exactly the roots of this thinking diagram. And to classify this, you just need to know ranks of matrices, right? I mean, that's sort of how you get the classification given any representation, or given any linear map like this. You have the kernel in the image, and sort of the only thing that matters is what the rank of that linear map is, and that classifies up to isomorphism. And rank makes sense in anything.
So for those of you who are physically here rather than electronic, we'll be continuing in 10 minutes on the 9th floor. We don't have this room, so back in the usual geometry seminar room, capital plus. More wonderful things. And for those of you who are not here, sorry. Let's thank the speaker again.